really feels like some practicing is going on. I'm going to share some words on the hindrances, which is actually one of my favorite components of the Dharma to speak about and be aware of for myself, particularly because it is applicable and an important factor for the practice, but also because it's relevant and very much alive in our everyday experience of living, which, as I've been saying over the course of the weekend, at some point hopefully becomes integrated and isn't viewed or experienced as one or the other. Today's theme is kind of, you know, loosely we're talking about being Dharma, which happens at some point after there's some integration of the practice, and it becomes almost like breathing. So that's one of the intentions of the practice, I think, in addition to, or maybe which becomes the result of, finding freedom. So one of the things that I really enjoy doing when I'm moving around in words is to go to the dictionary, see what the dictionary says about our English words that mostly originate out of other languages. You know, sometimes English leaves one wanting in terms of a real descriptive and clear understanding of a concept. So this word, hindrance, which I looked up in the dictionary, there were three components or three aspects that I felt were relevant to the speaking of hindrances as I'm going to be using today in this Buddhist philosophy. So the first definition that struck me as relevant was a hindrance being something immaterial that interferes with or delays action or progress. Second definition, which I felt was interesting to this conversation or this piece, was any obstruction that impedes or is burdensome. Any structure that makes progress difficult. And then the last definition, which then moves it into action or being a verb, the act of hindering or obstructing or impeding. So one of the things about the hindrances in terms of one aspect of the Dharma and the practice to be aware of and to actually engage with very intentionally is that if hindrances are showing up, or when they show up, I shouldn't even say if, they show up all the time. When hindrances show up, it's actually a real indicator that you're in the practice, that your awareness and your ability to pay attention to what's happening now in each moment is enlivened and bright, such that one is able to notice and be aware of the hindrance. In the Dhammapada, which is the Buddhist scripture of classic text of teachings and verses from the earliest period of Buddhism in India, there are two distinct goals that are stated for leading a spiritual life. The first is attaining happiness in this or in future lives. The second goal is the achievement of spiritual liberation, freedom, absolute peace. Many of the key themes of the verse are presented in dichotomies or pairs, for example, grief and suffering versus joy. Developing the mind versus being negligent about one's mental attitudes. Virtuous actions versus misconduct and being truthful versus being deceitful. It is written in this way to describe the difference between what leads to desirable outcomes and what does not. One of the verses in which the Buddha encapsulates the teachings of the Buddhas, the long history of Buddhas, doing no evil, engaging in what's skillful, and purifying one's mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. This verse gives a general overview of the teachings in terms of what Buddhas encourage people to actually do. The verse emphasizes ethical actions one should or shouldn't engage in, and the important role of ethics. Practicing mindfulness is easy. Remembering to do it is difficult. That's where our practice, we engage the energy and the effort and the conditioning to be able to bring to mind, to remember, to wake up. One of the, a question was asked yesterday in terms of not self, and how does one reconcile this concept of not self with a lot of the way the teaching addresses self and engaging with the self. And one of the things that I didn't say yesterday, which I wanted to bring forward, just a clarification, is that this self that is speaking of in terms of our practice and what it is designed to cultivate is the not conditioned self. So there's a self, I talked about it yesterday in terms of absolute and relative. So there's a conditioned self, and then there's the self that's never born and never dies. So that's just a clarification. The hindrances, if you engage with this practice and accept this philosophy and practice as a way to live a good and peaceful life, you have come upon many of the forces in the mind which can make it difficult to stay attentive to the present moment experience. These forces run the gamut from weak to powerful. What we have all experienced to varying degrees is that we are hampered oftentimes in our ability to remain mindful, to develop concentration, and to have clear insight. Our attention is pulled in many directions other than where we wish it to land and interferes with our effort to meditate. Even when we have the best of intentions to stay focused and present, these forces can propel us into states of preoccupation and distracted thinking. The good news is these forces and challenges offer an opportunity for the deepening of practice, an opportunity, not something to be averse to. And skill as meditators and are not bad or distractions or, goodness forbid, personal failing. It is a part of the path of practice to be mindful of them. These forces can serve us by forming the basis for cultivating awareness and wisdom. You know, one of the other maybe not clear understandings sometimes that we can come away with when studying the Dharma or hearing the words of the Dharma is this whole concept and activity of conditioning. So basically, I just wanted to elucidate that a big piece, this is why it's called the practice of what we're doing, is practicing skillful means or skillful habits that we then replace the unskillful means or unskillful habits with. So there's not a place as we walk this earth in these bodies where conditioning doesn't happen. It's the natural outlay of having a nervous system. But as we cleanse and purify our minds such that we get to see beyond the conditioning that's the result of greed, aversion, and delusion, then we get to revigorate or restructure or recondition ourselves in terms of skillful means. It is a necessary progression of practice to investigate the forces of distraction and agitation with the utmost care and honor. For they lay before us the opportunity to break through the cloud of confusion and reactivity our minds frequently dwell in. We must understand their true nature and how they work, as it is much easier to find freedom from something when we know it thoroughly. So secrets, the hiddenness, the turning away from, actually impedes our ability to move forward and deepen and strengthen our practice. And that's why you often hear people saying that this particular journey, this particular road, if you commit to walking it, is a road that takes courage, is a road that takes, like we spoke about yesterday, real intentionality around self-care and well-being. Where is that? I just wanted to... Okay, I don't see it. Perhaps you've heard the story on the night of Buddha's awakening, how Mara, the Buddhist personification of temptation and distraction, comes to him time and time again to undo the newly dawned freedom the Buddha achieved. Each time Mara arrives, the Buddha simply says, "Mara, I see you." After this happening time and time again, Mara relinquishes the notion that the Buddha will be turned away or turned around and flee. So seeing or recognizing Mara for the empty phenomena and not the truth of what it is was effective in bringing both freedom from Mara for Buddha as well as for ourselves. Something very important about understanding that one of the major components and aspects of this practice is actually seeing and knowing what's happening in the moment that it's happening. Although there can be numerous hindrances, there are five traditionally identified as particularly important for those of us taking this journey of Buddhist practice of mindfulness and meditation. Sooner or later, all meditators will have to address the hindrances. Often it is sooner and later because of how frequently they occur. These obstructing mind states should not be viewed as unfortunate occurrences, but rather as an opportunity to strengthen mindfulness, concentration, understanding, and non-clinging. There's one teacher who I think actually has been here, Utejaniya, who actually, that is the straight arrow of his teaching. He really centers and focuses around the opportunity that's present by engaging and working with the hindrances. And if he hasn't been here, you might want to take a look at one of his books. He's been here, okay. So the five hindrances are sensual desire, the mind wanting something pleasurable, grasping after sense objects. It keeps the mind looking outward, searching after this object or that in an agitated and unbalanced way. Sensual desire can be for food, for comfort, for physical, sexual experiences, sounds, smells, sights, and other sense pleasures. So basically, the outward extension of the aggregates, seeking pleasure or being averse to some external experience. It is the very nature of sense desires that they can never be satisfied. There is no end to the seeking. Living without wants, wishes, motivations, or aspirations is impossible. However, to approach freedom, we must emphasize skillful desires and distinguish the healthy, useful unhealthy, useful desires from the healthy ones. We become wise about harmful desires and understand the more we value freedom and its pleasures, the more likely freedom guides us in deciding which desires or aspirations we allow to guide our lives. There was this, I had a teaching for myself in this. I was at IMS doing a retreat as a yogi, and I think it must have been around this time of year because it was in the spring. And I came out to do some walking, and there was on one of the sides of one of the housing units, there were these beautiful lilies. They were like exploding with grandeur and beauty and color. And I was mesmerized. I stopped to pay attention. And it's almost like my thought was that this flower and this moment that I was seeing it was at the pinnacle of its self-expression. That's how beautiful it was. And then the mind kicked, the desire, oh, I want to keep that image. Let me go run and get my camera so that I can, whatever, put it up there as a screenshot or what. So I ran inside. Literally took me less than a minute to go get my camera. And I came back outside to this gorgeous flower, which was still pretty awesome, but I had missed the moment of change when it left that moment of peak self-expression, all for the desire to hold on, i.e. attach, cling to, this moment that I had of communing with this gorgeous flower. So fortunately, that's a pretty pleasant experience of how a hindrance might show up. But of course, we know that there are many unpleasant and difficult ways. But I thought I'd give you a pleasant one to hold on to for a minute. So then the next hindrance that I'll speak about is ill will or aversion. And that's one of the predominant ones, actually, that functions. The mind is filled with dislike, the condemning mind, anger, fury, resentment, hatred, annoyance, irritation, vexation, loathing, spite, resistance, avoidance, criticalness, boredom, complaining, grudge, and fearfulness. And I paused at boredom because as a teacher, as I've been working with retreatants and students and yogis, one of the most often expressed experiences that people have as they move into deepening the practices, I'm bored. And so I put that out there because there's many, many ways, some more subtle than others, that aversion shows up. And so to offer you the possibility of, as you work to purify the mind and engage with your practice in terms of grounding yourself in skillful means, to not stop at the first point, to take a look behind that and actually see what else might be going on, especially when it's things that show up like boredom or tired. It is the mind that strikes against the object and wants to get rid of it. Wisdom is actually acquired through intimate familiarity, and one of the tasks in mindfulness practice is to become familiar with the hindrances. With ill will, this requires a willingness to shift attention away from whatever we are hostile or averse towards, and instead turn our attention and investigation towards the experience of ill will itself. So often in practice, before we kind of, it locks in and we get it, we become so focused and attentive to whatever the object is, whatever the experience is, whatever the condition is out there that's causing some response or reaction in here, where the investigation is really the useful investigation and the place where we start to loosen or uncouple the experience from the conditioning, is to look at what the experience is that we're having, whether it's aversion or any other ones. But certainly with aversion, that's one of very useful way to work with it. It can be useful to be mindful of it in a non-judgmental and non-reactive way. Because everybody, it's part of being human. Nothing special about you or me. You know, no personal failing. We didn't practice enough, or we don't, you know, we have these external experiences which trigger or point various places in our nervous system, and oftentimes that's why it's like an ongoing practice. Oftentimes we're not even aware of that place in our nervous system until it gets triggered. So the way I look at it actually is, when something shows up, it's like goody goody. I get to handle this one. Then it's done. That's one way to think about it. Examine the beliefs that underlie the ill will. How do we believe aversion will be beneficial or justified? What assumptions do we believe about how things are supposed to be? What might ill will be covering? Frustrated desire, fear, embarrassment. With no aversion to aversion, mindfulness can make us independent of aversion. With no aversion to aversion, mindfulness can make us independent of aversion. The next hindrance that I'll speak to is sloth and torpor, that old school languaging around sleepy, tired, foggy, voggy, vaguey, that state that I'm sure all of us have experienced from time to time, or much of the time. Oftentimes it can look like, when you have a trauma history, it can look like you might be in a delusion or a flashback, but a lot of times it's sloth and torpor. That's something to keep in mind. Sloth and torpor, the mind is sleepy or too apathetic to see clearly. It is sluggish, laziness of mind, a mind that is heavy or dull. Sloth and torpor can arise from the absence of desire and aversion, the lack of stimulation that accompanies constant desire and aversion can be deflated and even depressing. So one of the things in our culture, in our society, we are addicted to stimulation. We're addicted to drama. So that's one thing to think about, that oftentimes when we start doing this practice, hopefully, drama starts to recede. There's not so much of it. It's not so much stimulation. And so on the way through to clear seeing, on the way through to awareness, what may show up when drama or stimulation are not so much a part of our lived experience is a kind of drowsiness, is a kind of sleepy, as we undo and restructure our relationship to experience. Sloth and torpor are forces in the mind that drain vitality and limit effort. Sloth manifests as a physical absence of vitality. The body may feel heavy, lethargic, or weak. Oftentimes, when this hindrance is strong, there is not even enough mindfulness to know we have fallen into it. Sloth and torpor refers to low energy states related to an attitude we are holding. Discouragement, frustration, boredom, indifference, giving up, hopelessness, and resistance are some of the mind states that cause sloth and torpor. Although sloth and torpor may be present, it does not mean that energy is not available, but just that we're not accessing it. Our evaluations and reactions often lead to lethargy. Learning how to mindfully watch over thoughts instead of actively participating in them can effectively stop them from draining our energy. Then there's restlessness and worry. The mind is too anxious to stay steady. Regret, agitation, jumping from one object to another without any mindfulness. Restlessness and worry, a state of over excitement. So where sloth and torpor was under energy, restlessness and worry is too much energy. What are the causes and conditions that give rise to restlessness? Well, you know, some of it we talked about yesterday in a very concrete way in terms of well-being and self-care. It's important to have enough exercise, sleep, good nutrition, because lack thereof can encourage restlessness. Not cause it, but create the conditions where restlessness easily comes forward. Watching too much TV, the internet, the phones, all of the technology that we're constantly engaged with during the day, when we're not managing the use of this technology, often, again, sets the condition for agitation and restlessness in the mind and the body. It's interesting, I don't know if anyone's ever tried this, except for when you go on retreat, maybe, and then there's another intention behind it. But it's really interesting, just in a day or a week of your life, to pick a morning or pick an afternoon where you don't go on technology at all. Like to intentionally create that experience for yourself, because technology and the way that we're using it, actually, we don't have an opportunity to see how engaged and addicted we are in the use of it while we're doing it. Just like any other addiction, you have to stop the thing that you're using in order to understand and be able to work with the intertwining of that behavior and that activity in the body. So that's just an interesting thing to try. You know, it's like many times in our culture over the hundreds and hundreds of years when something's invented or something's coming down the pike, like, artificial intelligence. Our body systems are behind the eight ball in terms of managing the technology. It takes some time, oftentimes, for the two to match up. So that's something to keep in mind. And just give a thought to it. You know, maybe actually use your technology, like set your phone to have a bell that rings every half hour or once on the hour. Like incorporate. I have a girlfriend, Sabine, I mentioned her name yesterday. She and her partner, they have some kind of app or some kind of thing that turns all their technology off at 9 o'clock at night. And then it turns it back on the next morning at 8 o'clock. So that's one way somebody has chosen to really moderate and work with the usage. It also can be useful to cultivate contentment. Breathe through the restlessness for calming. Releasing tension or constriction by using the breath can be relaxing. The more attention given to breathing, the less attention is available to fuel restlessness and worry. Being mindful of the cause is helpful, not the agitation. So that's the same thing that I was saying about some of the earlier hindrances. When pain, physical or emotional pain is the cause of the restlessness, don't try to hang in there and work with it. Work with the pain. That's not a time to like pay attention. You can investigate it a little bit. But like I said yesterday morning, I think, in one of the sits, you know, this practice is not about creating more suffering for ourselves. So if there's physical pain, mental pain, emotional pain, once you have the awareness of it, which is what can come through the use of the practice, then you have an intention, you set an intention, or you take an action to do something about the pain. Oftentimes, trauma and PTSD and vicarious trauma, or the experience and history of any of that, can also be fueling or influencing worry and agitation. And then the last hindrance, doubt, skeptical doubt, a lack of faith that you can stay mindful of what is true and to act skillfully. Doubt freezes the mind and undercuts your ability to cope with all the other hindrances. What am I doing here? Why did I come? I can't do it. It's too hard. I'd rather be sleeping. Doubt distances us from the present moment, so bringing mindfulness can be helpful in shifting from doubt. Although there are seven factors, four are always paired, which is why there are five when we speak of it. Gil Fronsdale, one of our teachers in California, suggests that one explanation for this is that the paired items represent closely related physical and mental factors. The first two hindrances are related by being opposite qualities, desire, ill will. They are both forms of wanting, although opposite sides of the same coin. Desire seeks to have something, whereas ill will wants to push something away. In a similar way, the third and fourth hindrances are related by being opposite qualities. They both relate to or involve levels of energy or vitality. Sloth and torpor are low energy states, while restlessness and worry are high energy states. The fifth hindrance of doubt, and it is not specifically connected with any of the other four in terms of a connection in that way. However, doubt is one of the hindrances, is the hindrance actually that oftentimes rides with, is initiated, is intertwined with any of the other hindrances. I think it's particularly, I don't know about particularly, but it's highly cultivated in our culture. Doubting oneself, doubting one's perceptions, doubting one's understanding. There's a lot of basis for that in our culture, which then creates a whole lot of other ways of being and conditions that we've been talking about over the last couple of days. When the hindrances are strong, we lose our ability to see clearly. These hindrances cloud our mind and prevent us from knowing the cause of our suffering. The hindrances are not only present in meditation, but actually permeate our daily lives to varying degrees. They cast a powerful influence on our lives. The Buddha taught that our minds are usually clouded with one or more of the hindrances, but because this is such a normal experience, we hardly notice it. He also said that the mind's natural state is clear, luminous, and free of any hindrance. Mindfulness practice returns the mind to this free state. When the mind is not obscured by hindrances, attachment doesn't arise, and your mind is willing and able to be with what is. You're not caught in wanting anything, wanting to become anything, or wanting to get rid of anything. Strong addiction to sense pleasure or ill will can cause us humans to do things and make choices we regret for decades, or even a lifetime, much less lifetimes. Actions motivated by the hindrances can be detrimental to ourselves, to others, and even to our whole society, which we have lots of evidence for these days. This lack of clarity can cause us to misunderstand which thoughts, words, and actions are harmful, and which are beneficial. If we purify the mind of hindrances, then the mind is no longer stiff and rigid. It becomes fluid and agile. The hindrances can also be seen as strategies we use when we are challenged or uncomfortable. And another way to put that in psychological terms, strategies that we use, i.e. defenses. A lot of times you can deconstruct a defense and at the bottom of it see that a hindrance is in action. It's happening. So how do we deal with this difficult mind states that obstruct us on our journey on this path? Firstly, we recognize them. We see them clearly in each moment. That recognition is the most powerful, effective way of overcoming them. Recognition leads to mindfulness. You know how when you're doing the sitting meditation, and I will often say, establish mindfulness, establish awareness. Mindfulness means not clinging, not condemning, and not identifying with the object. Mindfulness is the most effective way of dealing with the hindrances. So, offering you the thought of staying awake and not identifying. And sometimes, every now and then, you have a hindrance attack where all five of them are like active in the same moment. But the way to just like cut through that immediately is to recognize that's what's going on. Not get caught up in the story or the history of how it's felt in your body, how it's felt in your heart, how it's felt through your nervous system when you're agitated, when you're doubting. So, remembering that the hindrances operate in everyone. The presence of a hindrance is not a personal failure. We humans are born with the mental capacity for the hindrances. It's one of the tickets we purchase for the blessing of taking this ride called life. It is useful and wise to view their occurrences as something to include as part of our mindfulness practice and not some personal failing. There are no quick fixes to overcoming the hindrances. That's another thing this society is always looking for. And I would say pretty much at the basis of all the addiction in our culture. The more patiently and carefully we bring them into our practice to work with, the more probability we have of understanding. So just to give you a quick kind of an acronym that you can just employ and put into place in terms of working with the hindrances were developed by Gil Fronsdale again. He offers us a way to take the hindrances into our mindfulness practice, which consists of five different aspects. The acronym for this tool is BELLA, B-E-L-L-A. BELLA, which translates into English as beautiful. He says that this acronym describes the mind that is revealed when the hindrances are overcome and mindfulness becomes strong. So BELLA, B. When a hindrance appears, it is useful to first let it be, not acting on it or reacting to it. It is the training in staying present for our experience without being in conflict with it. No need to be discouraged, angry, or self-critical when faced with a hindrance. Letting a hindrance be is a practice of finding an inner stability in the face of destabilizing forces. Letting it be involves recognizing and acknowledging the hindrance. The clearer the recognition and mindfulness, the more we pull ourselves out of the web of confusion and non-clear seeing. This brings great freedom. Recognition also ensures our practice stays honest and realistic. BELLA, E, examine. This is said to be the most important aspect of our practice with the hindrances. Exploring the hindrances involves recognizing the components, its physical, energetic, cognitive, and motivational aspects. For example, if we take sense desire and deconstruct it physically, it may be experienced as a leaning forward, a tightening of the solar plexus, or a sense of lightness. Energetically, it may involve pressure, a sense of restlessness, or an upsurging of vitality. Emotionally, sense desire may invoke pleasant emotions like delight, excitement, or eagerness. Cognitively, sense desires may involve beliefs and stories we tell ourselves. And motivationally, sense desires may come as a strong impulse to act or cling or fix. Learning how hindrances arise, how they are removed, and how they can be prevented from arising requires attention and discernment. Bella, L, lesson, L-E-S-S-E-N, lesson. Lessen its strength. Relaxing both the body and mind are good ways to lessen the intensity of strong bouts with hindrances. If a hindrance is overwhelming, lessening its power might require removing yourself from the situation that reinforces it, or direct one's attention to something that has a calming effect. Focusing on an antidote to a hindrance can be helpful as well. Something like cultivating metta can help lessen ill will. Bella, second L, let go. Once we understand a hindrance, it can be appropriate to let go of it. For example, letting go of the thinking that perpetuates the hindrance. This ability to let go of the hindrance increases with practice. Letting go is like a muscle which grows stronger with practice and time, just like I think of it like being the gym of the mind. You know, so lifting the weights or being on the pulls or whatever. Just as we exercise our body, we exercise and train our minds. Bella, lastly, A, appreciate. When a hindrance is no longer present, it is useful to take time to experience its absence. To be mindful and present without being hijacked by a hindrance is a joy. Relief that arises when the mind is free of hindrances is a delight. Unhindered attention is a treasure. So, hope that was something you could walk out with. So let's just sit for a minute and let the words settle.